It was a lot less desolate than Ben recalled. The season had moved on, and the ground was covered in different plants, tussocks of tiny star-shaped red flowers with amber spikes for leaves. Shivu set the geo-survey droid to explore and drill some convincing core samples, just in case, and they walked the course. The CSF slang for revisiting a crime scene and pacing out distances and angles in the hope of getting fresh insight. They stood at the location where Mara's Stealth X had been found, looking for inspiration.
"Jason must have landed here in his Stealth X," said Shivu. "He was signed out from the GAG hangar during the relevant time frame, and we know your mother called Hapen ATC to say she knew he was in the area. So unless he switched vessels, we're looking for traces of that special Tabana isotope."
"Silgal's team did the sweep."
Ben had covered every angle. He was sure of that. But he wanted to be wrong, and for an unseen forensic revelation to emerge.
"Stealth X has kicked so much of it around on takeoff, the traces were spread over 500 meters. If Mom landed hers anywhere near Jason's, which is likely if she was going after him, then she wiped out his isotope footprint."
"Just checking."
"Let's do the tunnels."
It was the hardest thing of all. But Ben thought cop as Shivu advised, and saw only what was in front of him, not what might have taken place there. Silgal had found traces of blood on rubble that had fallen from a collapsed ceiling, as if it had hit someone below, but it had been too degraded by the energy of blaster fire to identify its source. It might have been his mother's. The sequence of events seemed clear, though. Someone, at least two people, had fought their way through the tunnels, causing huge damage. Some was blaster fire, and some showed no signs of its cause, which Ben guessed might have been massive force pushes.
"It's you, Jason. I know it. We all know it. But I have to have hard evidence," Ben thought.
Shivu looked more and more exasperated as he rescanned walls and floors, shaking his head as he looked at the readouts. The crime scene was months old.
"I think that's all we're going to get," said Ben. "Let's go."
"No, I'm not done," said Shivu.
They were back outside now. The sky was filling with clouds, threatening to spit light rain. Shivu went off to pace the distance from the Stealth X's last known location, seeing the terrain through Jason's eyes, he said, and Ben concentrated on his datapad again. It was hard to ignore the image of Mom. He thought of all the things he'd never had the chance to say to her, and magnified the picture so that the screen showed a close-up of her face. As Ben gazed at her image, he could have sworn it shifted slightly, as if something was wrong with the datapad's display. The screen reflected a short-lived shaft of sunlight. Ben angled it slightly to see better, and then his mother's face on the screen really did move, reflected from behind him, and he gulped in a silent gasp of air as he spun around, and she was there. Right there, looking straight into his eyes. She was a touch away from him. She looked just as she had in life, but bathed in a haze of faint blue-white light, like a faulty hologram. She smiled, a little sad frown of a smile, but a smile nonetheless, and buried the fingers of her right hand in her thick red hair to yank at it. Still smiling, she held out torn strands as if to drop them into his hands. Ben couldn't make a sound. He cupped his palm to catch the hairs, but nothing fell, and suddenly she was walking slowly away from him. He tried so hard to yell at her to stop, to wait, to talk to him, to come back, that he loved her so much. But she kept on walking, and all he could say was, "Love you." Then she turned, tugged at a lock of her hair, and he read her lips, "Love you too, Ben." And she was gone. Ben could hear only his hammering pulse now.
"Ben?" Shivu called. "Ben, are you okay?"
"Get a grip,"
Ben thought.
"Did you see anything, Lon?"
"You don't look so good."
"Did you see anything?"
"No, there's nothing here that I can see that was missed the first time. And if there was, it's weeks ago, and it's gone."
He caught Ben's shoulders with both hands.
"You look terrible." "Come on, let's sit you down in the transport. Get your bearings again."
"I'm fine,"
he said.
"Ben, I've got a flask of calf. Nice hot cup will make you feel better."
"Lon, when people fight, they leave all kinds of traces on each other, don't they?"
"Yes, but it's too late to ask for swabs from Jason. And do Jedi actually land punches?
No, but...
Stang! Shivu was furious. Stang, the Stealth X! We didn't test the Stealth X. In CSF, we'd normally go over that with a fine-tooth comb, as a matter of course.
Nobody thought it was Jason at the time. Nobody thought there might be anything to look for anyway, because we don't fight like non-force users, and...
What would we be looking for? Shivu asked. Come on, Ben. What's on your mind? Ben swallowed.
Hair. Mom's hair.
Bevin Vazor Farm, outside Keldabe.
Dr. Belluin gave Sintis another shot of tranquilizer and checked her pulse. This time, she didn't lash out.
I wouldn't usually administer this, he said, but she'll injure herself knocking into things if she isn't sedated.
They do say.
Stop talking about me as if I'm dead, Sintis snapped. Everything's so loud. Where am I? Why can't I see?
She looked dazed now, but it was an improvement on stumbling around the room. She sounded sane enough, too, but sanity was a fragile thing, and Fett knew the odds. It was 50-50 that she'd ever be completely normal again. He didn't know where to start explaining, and even Myrta, who usually had all the smart answers, erred on the side of extreme caution. Sintis sat on the bed, hugging her knees, blind gaze wandering unsteadily between voices.
You're Sintis Vell, Medrid said quietly. You've been encased in carbonite for a while. You know what that is?
Of course I do.
Okay. You're in Keldabe, on Mandalore, on Medrid Vasor. This is my farm. You can stay here until you're well enough to leave. What's the last thing you can remember?
Sintis stared straight ahead, sightless.
Where's my necklace?
Can you remember a necklace, madam?
Belluin asked.
I had a necklace. Where is it?
Belluin turned to Fett.
Did she?
Yes, she did.
It's very encouraging that she recalls it.
Fett looked at Myrta, their eyes locked, and she reached inside her collar to take off the Heart of Fire, or at least the half of it that wasn't buried with Aelin. He'd given it to Sintis as a marriage gift when they were both too young to know any better, but that wasn't what made his gut tighten now. Sintis was from Khifu. The gem, one of the rare gold ones, shot with inner light in a rainbow of colors, was said to hold part of the soul of the giver and the receiver. Kifar could sense the memories stored in the stones as if it were a data crystal, but with the added layer, the added unasked-for complications, Fett thought, of the emotional elements. Even if she was crazy or blind, that stone might just speak to Sintis and jog her memory far too fast for his liking. Belluin pulled up a chair beside the bed and spoke to Sintis in his best bedside manner.
Do you recall being in carbonite, my dear? Were you conscious?
Sintis jerked her head as she heard the medroid enter.
Nothing. I don't remember a thing. And you can keep that droid away from me, too.
Myrta dangled the Heart of Fire from its leather cord wrapped around her forefinger. She gave Fett a meaningful look. Now or never, Babuir, and approached Sintis cautiously.
Here's your necklace,
she said. She wrapped her grandmother's hand around the stone, folding her fingers gently.
I kept it safe for you. My name's Myrta Gev. We never met, but I'm a relative of yours.
Sintis froze for a moment, almost massaging the Heart of Fire in her hand, gaze fixed.
It's not the way I remember it.
Fett detached at that point. He learned to do it in the days after his father was killed, a trick of flipping a switch between emotions rubbed raw and complete numbness.
We had to break it. You can get another one.
Sintis turned her head slowly toward him, and for a moment, he expected her to recognize his voice.
And do I know you?
Sintis asked. Belluin leaned close to Fett.
It might be too much too soon. The case studies I've read say that excessively rapid exposure to their real situation can cause carbonite patients to go into a catatonic state.
Fett got the picture. He grabbed the excuse.
A long time ago, Sintis,
The name felt alien in his mouth. He didn't dare use his pet name for her, Sin. She called him Bo. Those were relics of a brief, happy time.
Get some rest.
Oyubat Tapkaf, Keldabe.
It was the last place in the galaxy that Jaina had expected to run into another Jedi, and she definitely hadn't expected to meet one who would pull a blaster on her either. But she was staring a blaster in the muzzle right now.
I'm right, aren't I? Said the old man. You're a Jedi.
She wasn't imagining it. The old man made a big, disciplined impression in the Force, as if he'd been trained. The other man in the multicolored armor, now that was harder to pin down, but she was sure he was Force-sensitive. The crowd in the Tapkaf had suddenly lost interest in the bolo ball, and every single one of them had drawn at least one blaster on her. Some had two.
Where's her lightsaber?
Asked the vine-tattooed man.
She's not carrying it.
The old Mandalorian didn't even blink.
I had a very strong feeling you'd arrived.
I'm Jaina Solo, she said at last, and I've come to ask Fett to help me.
Didn't we save your papa's Shebs at Kalua Station? Asked the tattooed man. Ask him if he remembers the funny folks in armor who were killing the Vongese for him. It might jog his memory. And tell him Kareed sends his best.
I apologize for sneaking in, Jaina said.
Give her some credit for coming here unarmed, at least.
The man in the motley armor took off his helmet, a blood-red and gray thing that didn't match another plate on him. He was in his 50s, with very dark eyes and gray-streaked black hair.
I'm Venku, also known as Kadika.
He looked at the old man with a distracted fondness.
My respected Ori Buir here is Gotab.
Well, so we all know what we are.
We're Mandalorians, Jedi Solo, said Venku. What did you think we were?
It struck Jaina that maybe the rest of Keldabe didn't know these men were Force-sensitive. Given the enmity between Jedi and Mandalorians, maybe they were undercover or stranded here, or... No. She couldn't come up with a plausible explanation. She couldn't imagine any Jedi being out of the loop for so long that she didn't know of them. But there was always the possibility that they weren't Jedi, and just Force-sensitives. But the old man radiated trained powers, and a sense of healing, of reconciliation, of all kinds of soothing things that didn't go with the blaster or his hostile expression. He wasn't a random genetic event.
Doesn't matter, Jaina said at last. My mother came here during the Empire's occupation. She met your leader at the time. In fact, she...
We're doing a lot better than we were in your mother's day. No thanks to the New Republic. Or the GA. Have you come to negotiate some arms deal?
In a way, I suppose I have.
Fett's on his way, said Bevin. And most deals are negotiable.
Gotab, apparently satisfied that there were enough blasters trained on Jaina to allow him to rest, slid his weapon back in his belt and replaced his helmet.
We'll be going, Venku said. Bevin, if you need anything, call.
Jaina leaned her back against the bar and thought better of trying to make small talk with Bevin, who was managing both to keep her in his field of vision and yet not to meet her eye. Eventually, patrons holstered their blasters and went back to their ale, muttering about missing the end of the bolo ball match, thanks to the Shabla Jedi.
In basic, so that I know I've ticked them off. Good start, Jaina thought.
Then the doors opened, and a man in dull green armor and a tattered cloak stood in the entrance. Her impression in the Force was one of a lonely man, resigned to being that way.
Was this Fett?
Jaina thought. He came to a halt a meter in front of her and hooked one thumb in his belt, his other hand steadying an EE-3 blaster that hung from a shoulder sling. Then she spotted the Wookiee scalps.
Oh, it was him, Jaina thought.
You wanted to see me, Jedi?
Fett?
There have been imposters, but I think I got them all. Let me know if I missed any.
I'm Jaina Solo.
We know.
He tilted his head a fraction.
You look like your mother.
You saved my father a couple of times, Jaina said. I ought to thank you.
I handed him over to Jabba too, but I did time in the Sarlacc thanks to him, so we're even. What do you want from me?
Jaina had to play this carefully. It's my brother, Jason.
The cowardly barb who killed my daughter?
I'm afraid so. I want you to teach me how to capture him and stop him destroying the galaxy.
Coruscant, Lon Shivu's apartment.
Can you trust Captain Geerdyn?
Ben asked. As much as a hot, Shivu said, sitting with his elbows braced on his knees, head resting on his hands. He stared at the holochart propped against the chair as if he were trying to levitate it.
He's a career man, and trust has a very different meaning for our colleagues who are recruited from the intelligence services. Let's say it's flexible.
They had to get access to Jason's Stealth X. Ben would have difficulty infiltrating the GAG hangars. Not impossible, but not a stroll either. And even Shivu, with all his valid pass cards, would draw attention if he so much as popped the canopy. They needed an hour in a cramped, conspicuous space to do painstaking work.
Maintenance, Shivu said. Somehow we need an excuse to call it in for servicing.
Don't Stealth X's have a 1,000-hour maintenance interval?
Unfortunately. And I don't think INCOM will oblige us with a recall.
I better call Dad, Ben said. Don't worry, we'll think of something.
Ben suspected that his father would have a good idea of what he was doing, even if he didn't know where he was doing it. He'd break it like he planned, gently, audio only.
Hi, Dad. How you doing?
Luke sounded as if he was making an effort to switch into an upbeat voice.
I'm okay. Where are you? I can't trace the link.
Coruscant.
I thought as much.
Dad, I'm pretty sure Jason was implicated in Mom's murder. He's worse than you imagine, Dad. He just killed one of his own crew. He broke her neck.
I know. Admiral Nyathol told me.
Nyathol?
Shivu looked up at the mention of her name.
She's moved from being helpful to us to taking the risk of contacting me direct. Ben, I've told her to trust Shivu.
Where do you think I am?
There you go. You trust him too.
How far do you think she'll stick her neck out?
Pretty far.
You might hear that I've asked a favor of her then, Dad, sooner or later.
Joint Chief of State Nyathol's suite.
Nyathol consulted the fleet status repeater display on her office wall, known as the tote board with the service, and noted that the Anakin Solo had returned from Fondor.
He's always been a day tripper,
she said to her droid administrator, recalling Jason's unexplained absences in previous months.
If I didn't know he was wasting munitions on pointless exercises, I'd say he had a secret lover.
There was minor enemy contact off Fondor.
How off?
In Fondorian space.
I hate it when he throws stones and goads them. I'll assume he's testing their resolve before the big push.
I believe he was training his new assistant.
Is that girl even enlisted? I won't have civilians playing battleships, not in my navy. At least the Skywalker boy had a proper commission.
She remains a civilian, Admiral.
Nyathol stared in slight defocus at the image of Mon Calamari on her office wall, losing herself in the unbroken horizon beyond Reef home. Her home. And wondering when she might find time for shore leave again.
Colonel Solo to see you, Admiral,
said the droid, using their military titles. Jason strode in and perched his behind on the edge of a table facing her desk. He was close to knocking off a pile of flimsy and data pads with his long black cloak, and that casualness annoyed her almost as much as the fact that his businesslike black GAG fatigues had given way to this pointlessly dramatic wardrobe. I'm hearing interested noises from some of the Moffs about joining the GA, he said. They're thinking thoughts of Empire again.
Heard personally?
She asked. Jason had said he wouldn't negotiate without her explicit involvement.
Or does this emanate from their gentlemen's clubs and smoke-filled tapcafs again?
Let's say the latter.
How? I'm fed up guessing like this is some party entertainment.
The military attaché was passing through Munalist at the same time as a Moff who has relatives there.
Doing charity work for bank employees, no doubt.
If I'd sent him to talk to the Moffs in Ravlin itself, you'd have accused me of bypassing you.
I would.
Nyathol worried about the Moffs.
What impression have you given them?
Jason slid off the edge of the table and activated Niathal's holochart, the one she used when she had staff meetings. He zoomed in on the northeast quadrant, filling the table with translucent planets, stars, and threads of colored light representing the major hyperspace routes. Here's what we've hinted is on the table, he said, thrusting his fingertip into a cluster of worlds to the Enzoth side of the core. Borleos and Bilbringi. The deal is that if they commit their considerable military machine to the war effort, then their reward will be a major expansion of their territory. Jason tilted his head this way and that to consider the three-dimensional view of the galaxy's flattened disk. So I suggest we ask them to help us take Fondor.
You realize that the Remnant might think Fondor is up for grabs too, seeing as Borleos and Bilbringi would extend their range to within striking distance of that side of the core.
They might well think that.
Don't play games with them, Jason. They'd be awfully close neighbors to Coruscant.
And with enough corridor to defend between Bastion and Borleos to keep them too busy to start getting ideas about us. And Palian. Never forget Palian. He knows how to keep the Moffs in line, so when we have his blessing, we can move.
If,
said Niathal,
if we get his blessing, he hates your guts.
So do you, Admiral, Jason smiled. But we still work well together. It's an efficient strategy. Two beings with no love lost between them, maneuvering.
I agree that we should take Fondor out of the game sooner rather than later.
Is that a yes to formally approaching the Imperial Remnant?
It'll make us look as if we can't handle the job on our own. But yes, we're at overstretch. I can't complain having nagged you about that so often.
Excellent, Jason said. He seemed as pleased as a child being told he could hold a party and invite friends. I'll send Tahiri Vela to see Palian.
Very well. But next time you want her to play with cannons, make sure she's a member of the Defense Force. Give her a commission. Enlist her. If you don't think she's officer material, but make sure she understands wars are not for civilians.
Jason's guard seemed as down as it ever would be. They'd argued, after a fashion admitted they disliked each other, and yet reached an agreement. All mistrust seemed to have been aired. Niathal slid in her knife.
What kind of Jedi are you, Jason? Because my meetings with the Jedi Council were never quite so target-oriented and ruthless.
I don't do things their way, it's true.
Are you a Sith?
Jason's loss of composure was always betrayed by his eyes. What do you know about Sith? He asked, all quiet reason.
Oh, not much. I know Palpatine was a Sith, and he was a brilliant tactician. No quarter given, all exits sealed. The kind of total war that I could never see Master Skywalker waging in an eternity. Which is why I ask, because your ability to see the whole picture reminds me of that.
Yes, Jason said quietly. I'm a Sith.
We should teach Sith tactics at the Academy, then,
said Niathal. Jason gave her that patronizing smile that said he didn't think she understood what was happening and pitied her for being so inadequate. I'll brief Tahiri, he said, and left. Niathal suspected that Tahiri was already on her way, but it didn't matter. She sat looking at the holochart and wondering how an Imperial Moff might see it, what temptations it might suggest.
Admiral, Captain Shivu asks if you can spare him 5 minutes.
Yes, show him in.
Niathal shut down the holochart and had the feeling she might need to erase a little of the droid's memory.
If anyone calls, tell them I'm in a procurement planning meeting.
Shivu wasn't the kind of officer who popped in for a chat. Niathal had almost expected him, since Luke Skywalker had identified him to her as a potential ally. And he hadn't wasted any time, considering he was the most senior officer in Jason's personal elite, 967 Commando of the Galactic Alliance Guard. He was taking a huge risk, and Jason couldn't have made a worse-placed enemy. She gestured to him to take a seat and wondered who would say it first.
It's all right. I sweep the office for surveillance devices every time I enter it.
Shivu slid a small scanner out of his pocket and aimed it at various points around the office before looking a little more relaxed. So do I.
So we understand each other.
I think so.
What can I do for you?
I need to carry out forensic tests on your colleague's Stealth X. Is there any way I can get access to it, uninterrupted for a few hours?
He's gone to brief his new minion for a mission to Bastion.
Niathal ran through all the routine procedures a Stealth X would undergo and why. Jason's was one of the few that the Jedi pilots hadn't taken when they withdrew.
How urgent is this?
We should have done it 3 months ago, Shivu said. He mouthed Mara at her. Might turn up nothing, of course.
If you do it, won't he sense that you've been in the vessel?
That's why I'm getting a droid to do it.
Very well, Captain. I'll arrange for the ground crew droids and personnel to be told it needs a special examination. Checking for canopy seal integrity, fuel leaks into the cockpit, whatever I can think of. In fact, let's do all the space-capable vessels the GAG has, too, to make it look convincing. You don't have that many.
Thank you, Admiral.
You know how dangerous it is to go after him, don't you?
Niathal said. Not half as dangerous as it will be if I don't, said Shivu.
Oyubat Tapkaf, Keldabe.
What can I possibly teach you, Jedi?
Fett asked.
You've killed and captured more Jedi than anyone, Jaina said.
Oh, I don't know. Some of my brothers racked up some pretty good score back in the day.
Jason and I are matched in terms of force strengths, but he's picked up training and force techniques I don't even understand. So my best chance of taking him is to use skills he doesn't have. And I'm pretty sure you never gave him the top 10 Mandalorian tips on Jedi busting.
Only if he paid me. But what do you care about Aelin?
It's not only your daughter he's killed. He might have even been involved in Mara Skywalker's death.
Ah, so that's when you decide he needs stopping. When it's a Jedi getting killed.
Bevin hauled himself onto a bar stool and put his helmet to one side while he thumbed through his datapad.
He kills his underlings too, Mandalore.
He held out the pad so that Fett could see the message from one of his long list of informants. Coruscant wasn't half as far from Mandalore as it thought it was.
Look, Ma, no hands. He's learned to break necks with the Force. Some lieutenant called to boot, and it's the talk of the fleet. Well, the people I know in the fleet, anyway. He's so adorable.
Just like old times,
Fett said.
Except I almost liked Vader.
You sent the crush gaunts, said Jaina. So we took that as a big hint.
Try 10 tons of high-spec thermal detonator.
We want him alive.
Alive's always more complicated. Only do alive if they pay extra, Jedi.
Fett laid his blaster on the counter and removed his helmet two-handed. Fett watched Jaina's eyes take him in.
If I don't do it, she said, I don't think anyone else can.
Bevin was used to playing a double act with Fett at times like this. Nice Mondo, nasty Mondo. He slipped into the role without even needing a cue, while Fett just stared into Jaina's face, testing her nerve.
You've got a lightsaber, lady, and Jason Solo doesn't have a Beskar scam,
Bevin said.
What can we possibly teach you? Ambush? Blaster masterclass?
Jaina's eyes never left Fett's.
Fett, she said, undistracted. You can teach me to bring down Jedi. You've done it often enough.
Fett counted 2 beats.
And in the war, just when our economy's getting back on its feet.
You'd sacrifice whole worlds for your own ends?
You sacrifice Mandalore to the Vong for your own ends.
I'm sorry we didn't give you the reconstruction aid we should have, Fett. I'm not proud of that. But can't you see what Jason's going to do if he carries on? I need to stop him before he consolidates his power.
Fett looked Jaina up and down. She was small, and her smooth hands said that she'd never had to build an entrenchment with them. But she was a Jedi. He could treble her weight and reach based on that alone. And she was going after her brother, whether Fett trained her or not. He could see it in her eyes. A little fear. Maybe not of him, and shame that she'd even had to ask the favor. It clearly stuck in her throat to beg her father's old enemy for anything. but she was going to tough it out to get a necessary job done. Fett respected that, and it was the first lesson any bounty hunter needed to learn, to forget the emotional baggage and focus solely on an objective.
Okay, I'll do. And it's gonna cost.
When do we start?
We already have. I'll be back tomorrow. Take a room here and get a good night's sleep.
Bevin Vazor Farm, near Keldabi.
Fett waited outside the door for a few moments. He could hear the droid whirring as it moved around the bedroom, and Dr. Belluine's murmuring voice. As soon as the doctor came out, he'd go in and sit with Sintas for a while. After that, he'd start his sessions with Jaina Solo. His day was planned.
Grandmama keeps asking where she is.
Myrta came up behind him and nudged him in the small of his back.
We keep telling her, but her short-term memory is shot to Haran.
Early days.
She won't let go of the Heart of Fire.
Did you call her Grandmama?
I thought that would be asking for trouble, Babu-ir.
Fett heard boots in the passage behind him, slow and careful, like someone was creeping in and trying not to be noticed.
Morning, Orade.
Sakui, Mandalore.
Guess Orade, Myrta's new love, stopped in his tracks, clutching some wild Vormir blooms.
I brought some flowers for Sintas.
She's blind.
Orade gave Fett a look that said, heartless barv.
She can smell the scent.
It was a nice touch, something Fett hadn't thought about.
You marrying Myrta then?
Yes, Mandalore.
You're the only Manduard on this planet who cowers to me. Don't.
Okay,
said Orade, spine stiffening.
I'm marrying Myrta, and if anyone has to take care of her grandmother long term, it'll be us.
My grandson-in-law. Fear feck.
Fett assessed him, and thought he'd do. The door swung open and Belluine came out, looking anxious. Fett took him to one side while Myrta and Orade slipped into the room.
Is she going to get better?
The fact that she's alert and mobile is remarkable enough.
Belluine lowered his voice so that Fett had to strain to hear him, but he seemed indignant that his treatment hadn't been appreciated.
Most cases were in some degree of coma for months. Her Kifar brain chemistry may have offered some protection from the worst of the carbonite trauma.
Kifar were different, Fett knew that. The ability to detect past events from inanimate objects was proof of that.
So she might improve.
She might. Carboniting affects neural connections in the brain. That's why your wife can't see, and why her memory is affected. Given time, neurons do regenerate. Stimulation helps. Little mental exercises to stimulate her memory. Objects she might remember, like the necklace, hollow images, that kind of thing.
You're saying she's brain damaged?
Technically, yes, but therapy...
I'll find Sintas what she needs. If I need you, I'll call you.
Belluine was always good at knowing when he'd been dismissed. Myrta stuck her head out of the doorway, face set in a frown.
Whatever Medrit says, Belluine did a good job, she said. You're so ungrateful. Grandmama could easily have died.
Fett walked in and sat down at the bedside. Sintas was sitting cross-legged on the mattress, turning the Heart of Fire over in her hands as if she was searching.
Who are you?
She asked, turning her face to him.
I knew you when you were younger.
What's your name?
Boba. Boba Fett.
He expected the world to come crashing down at that moment, but Sintas just looked blank, as if she was trying to remember something minor, not the man who'd put a huge dent in her life.
I'm Sintas Vel. You're Boba Fett, and she's...
Myrta took up position on the opposite side of the bed.
I'm Myrta Gev. Yeah, Myrta. Are you my little girl? I have a daughter.
Fett switched off. He hadn't planned to, but it happened automatically. It was like a thermostat switch that tripped whenever things were in danger of overheating.
Aelin. Your daughter's name was Aelin. She was about 16 last time you saw her.
I have to find her. She'll be wondering where I am.
Myrta fixed Fett with a stare that said, don't even think about it.
Lots of things happened while you've been in Carbonite.
Myrta took a deep breath.
I'm your granddaughter.
Sintas didn't react for a while. She kept turning the Heart of Fire between her fingers, lips moving silently. She placed the Heart of Fire around her neck, one hand still clutching the stone. Orade leaned over and held the flowers in front of her. Myrta got up and took something from the cupboard, something Fett hadn't seen in a very long time. It was a red, oblong canister with a handle on the top.
"We found this in Rizodar's effects,"
Myrta said, opening the lid. A hologram leapt into life with a faint hum, triggered by the mechanism. The hologram showed Sintis holding a baby, all smiles, and Fett standing with one arm around her shoulder.
"What is it?"
Cinta asked, reaching out toward the source of the hum.
"It's an old hologram,"
Mira said gently.
"It's you, and your daughter, I think. My mother and your husband."
Sintis half-smiled, looking embarrassed.
"I have a husband? What happened to him? How long have I been out of it? Come on, tell me!"
Fett took a long, slow breath, in the same way he did to prep for storming a room.
38 years.
He looked Sintis straight in the eye, although she couldn't see him.
"And I was your husband. I'm Boba Fett."
Sintis' eyes moved from side to side, as if she was searching.
"Who carbonited me?"
"I don't know yet."
"But you found me?"
"Yeah."
"You found me?"
"We found you. Myrta did all the work."
"I don't remember. I don't remember anything, but if you came for me, after all that time, you were still looking."
Fett parted his lips to explain that it wasn't quite like that, but Myrta held up a warning finger. "She doesn't need to know that right now." He stopped in his tracks.
"You're going to be fine. I'll come back later."
It was a tactical withdrawal. When Fett turned, Bevin was standing in the doorway with his arms folded. He stepped back to let Fett pass, and then followed him down the passage through to the front of the farmhouse.
"I could take the Jedi off your hands today,"
Bevin suggested.
"Unless you want to be elsewhere."
"Sooner I kill the idea that I'm some devoted husband, the better. Just makes it harder for her when she finally gets the full picture."
He reached the front entrance, but Madrid was blocking it.
"Wait,"
Madrid said imperiously.
"No sparring with Jatise until you're properly dressed."
He crooked a soot-stained finger at Fett and led him to his workshop.
"Heads will not roll, okay?"
Laid out on the bench was a set of armor plates, the mid-green paint still unmarked. It was a common color for Mandalorians. It happened to be Fett's color, too.
"Might as well make the most of the new Beskar deposits."
Medrit picked up the breastplate and twirled it between his hands.
"I said you should ditch the Durasteel armor, didn't I? Here's your proper Beskar gam. Wear it in case the Jedi gets lucky. She'll need to hack away with a Jetty Cad for a week to dent this."
"Humor him,"
Bevin said.
"He made a collar section specially."
Fett didn't plan on testing the Beskar gam in earnest, but the collar intrigued him. It was a near-circular band that hinged open and protected the neck between the helmet and gorget plate. If his father had worn one, he would probably have survived Mace Windu's decapitating lightsaber blow. Fett slipped it on and rolled his head to test the range of movement in it.
"It's good, Madrid. Thanks."
Bevin helped him attach the rest of the plates. The new helmet, he'd sort that later himself. The Durasteel one would do for today. He swung his arms a few times and accustomed himself to the extra weight before replacing his jetpack and Wookiee braids, and then set off for the hangar that he'd earmarked as a training area. Bevin followed him.
"You want to watch the show? I'm just going to see what skills she's got first."
Jaina was waiting for them in the barn, looking very small and dejected as she sat on an upturned pail. She flinched when Fett approached her.
"Something wrong?" she asked.
"Family problems."
"Yeah, tell me about it."
She stood up.
"Your granddaughter?"
"My ex-wife. She's just shown up after being carbonated for 38 years, and she doesn't know your brother killed her daughter yet."
"If you'd rather be with her now..."
"We've got work to do."
His eyes met Jaina's, and he saw a shared pain he wasn't expecting. For a heartbeat, they looked at each other, and he could have sworn there was some sympathy, some real compassion in her. He didn't like that at all. Jaina drew her lightsaber with slow caution, as if she didn't want to make anyone too jumpy.
"Want to see what I can do?"
Fett's mind emptied instantly of all superfluous thought. Combat was cleansing. He'd done this so often that it was almost a form of meditation. He was in his natural element again, freed from the alien world of relationships he'd never learned to handle. But he'd learned to master every weapon the galaxy had to offer, bar one.
"Me too," said Fett, drawing a lightsaber. "We can teach each other some new tricks."
Jaina had thought that she might start her bizarre apprenticeship with a discussion about Jason's prodigious catalog of force powers, but it wasn't to be.
"I'm no swordsman,"
Fett said, holding the lightsaber like a hammer as he circled her.
"And I've never trained anyone. It'll be an education for both of us."
Jaina matched his movements, keeping a constant distance from him. She was aware of Bevin as a deep blue blur to her right, watching, and she didn't feel comfortable.
"I want to learn what Jason hasn't," she said.
Fett stopped and stood with his head slightly tilted.
"Tell me what it can do, other than kill unarmed women without touching them."
Jaina felt Bevin move slowly out of her peripheral vision.
"Apart from the Academy basics?"
"Apart from the leaping, mind-influencing, throwing rocks around with his mind."
"Telekinesis."
Jaina took a step back to keep Bevin in physical view.
"I've known him to move starships, deflect ion cannon, even turbo lasers. He can hear at huge distances with some Theran force listening technique. He can create elaborate force illusions that feel real. He can walk into the past or future. He can control objects like scanners. And he can mind rub. He even mind rubbed Ben."
"Made him forget?"
"Yes."
"He could get rich on that."
Fett didn't sound as if he were mocking.
"Why does he need spies and secret police if he can eavesdrop wherever he wants?"
I don't know.
"If he can stop turbo lasers single-handed, why does he need a fleet?"
Jaina looked for the angle.
"Again, no idea."
"Why does he need shields on ships when he can create his own?"
She was balanced on the balls of her feet now, ready to leap. It was so instinctive, so ingrained by training, that she couldn't override it. She felt threatened. In the corner of her eye, the thin strip of light that marked the barn doors expanded into a wider ribbon, and someone, several someones, came in. She had an audience. Fett lowered the lightsaber and held it with its tip just above the dusty floor.
"Anything else?"
"We can't sense him in the Force."
"Welcome to the mundane world."
"And he can make himself invisible sometimes."
Bevin burst out laughing.
"Hori gar ori shukla!"
Jaina almost turned, triggered by the simple instinct to face the source of a sudden sound, but she fought it. Fett was totally relaxed, now a couple of meters from her, lightsaber held loosely in one gloved hand. His armor looked different, cleaner, brighter. Maybe he'd put on his holiday best.
"What's that mean, Myrta?"
One of the Mandalorians who'd come in as a young woman, Jaina remembered. His granddaughter. The one Mom and Dad met. The one who tried to kill him.
Bevin says, "Oh dear, you're totally screwed, Jedi."
Myrta moved into her field of view behind Fett, a figure in egg yolk yellow plates with her helmet under one arm. She felt sharp and bitter now.
"Jason's very clever, isn't he?"
"He killed her mother. Oh boy," Jaina thought.
"You've got problems, Solo,"
Fett said, hooking his thumb in his belt, weight still on his right leg.
"How are you gonna take him then?"
She had no answers yet. Fett shrugged, and then, the next thing she knew, the wind was knocked out of her as he landed a punch in her gut. Her lightsaber was back on and slashing up across Fett's chest in a split second. Unplanned, she snapped straight into instant raw instinct. Fett fell back a couple of steps. Jaina bent almost double, gasping for air as her solar plexus screamed in agonized protest at the punch. But she held her lightsaber out in front of her to ward him off. Nobody had ever jumped her like that before. She hadn't sensed it coming.
"What's that?"
"Listen over,"
Fett said, inspecting his chest plate. Jaina's eyes were watering, but she could see a scorch mark across Fett from belly to chin. The green paint burned away in a line that spanned the sections of armor, like a careless black brushstroke exposing a streak of bare gray metal beneath.
"Hurts, doesn't it?"
Jaina steadied her breathing with a little help from the Force to settle the disruptive nerve impulses.
"And there's
a point to all that?"
she said. Fett still held the lightsaber hilt in his right hand. He'd used it like a knuckle duster, and 70 plus or not, he still had a serious punch on him.
"I hope..."
"There is. I'm waiting for you to work it out."
Jaina straightened up and finally decided it was safe to deactivate her lightsaber.
"So that's Beskar armor, is it?"
"Beskar gam," Bevine said behind her. "It means iron skin."
Bevine, helmet under one arm and a pleasant smile on his face, drew his saber one-handed and held it vertically so that Jaina could look at it.
"If you're willing to spar with me, I'll assess your technique."
"Modest, aren't we?"
Jaina said.
"Does your brother know how you handle a lightsaber?"
"Yes."
"So maybe I can show you how he might use that technique against you."
"Of course. Thank you."
Fett had psyched her out. That was it. It had to be. Now that she could pause to look at her small audience, she found it was a big man in dark gray armor, face obscured by a helmet, a young blonde bearded man who seemed to be with Myrta, and another older man with magnificent black matted braids strung with gold clips, his ebony skin marked with raised scars. He gave her a knowing wink. If she'd met him in another context, she would have taken an instant liking to him.
"Don't you get it, Solo?"
Fett asked.
"You played on your propaganda, I think."
"No, I played on your mistakes. You read my body language wrong. You assumed you were safe."
"It's hard to sense danger from you." She gestured with her thumb at Bevine. "I was picking up more from our friend here."
"And you still held back."
She pointed to the burn across his plates.
"Hey, I hit you fair and square."
"You assume too much. You're just training. Nobody wants to hurt you. The nice Mondo is helping you. He's standing all wrong to attack. You want to win? Start out to win. Hit first."
"You're telling me to fight dirty. I get that."
"No. I'm telling you this isn't about lightsaber technique. I'm more than twice your age, no force powers, and I still got you to drop your guard. Winning isn't about being better. It's finding your opponent's weakness and exploiting it."
"So what's Jason's?"
"What's yours?"
Jaina chewed her lip in thought, aware of Myrta's gaze. The realization dawned on her.
"I use appropriate force, with a small F. I follow the rules of combat."
"Good."
Fett rolled the lightsaber hilt in his palm and then slid it into the dump pouch on the thigh of his pants.
"You're learning. Next lesson, Goron will show you how to go crazy with a blade."
Imperial Palace, City of Ravelin, Bastion. 2 days later.
"Show the young lady in, Vitor."
Receiving visitors in the palace drawing room always reminded them what they were dealing with, Palian thought. It was an imposing chamber that whispered casual wealth. It hinted that the Empire didn't have to try too hard. Tahiri Vela glided into the room right on time. Her bright blonde hair and general artless demeanor made her look too young to be sent on a task like this, although the Yuuzhan Vong marking still visible on her forehead evoked unpleasant memories. Palian stood and ushered her to her chair. The spell was definitely broken before she'd even had a chance to cast it.
"Is this your first visit to Bastion? If it is, don't leave without seeing the Imperial Gardens."
"I'll make a note of that, Admiral."
"So..."
He settled down in his seat, making a point of being slow and old, looking like easy prey.
"We live in challenging times, but here in our little backwater we've managed to avoid the war. And I'm wondering what could possibly make it worth our while stepping out into that fray."
"You have a very small empire."
"But it's perfectly formed."
"Here's our view in the GA.
Tahiri leaned forward slightly, like an earnest student.
"The longer the war goes on, the worse prospects for all of us, not just those directly involved in the fighting. We want stability. What we have is not just a split between GA and Confederation, but also systems unaligned to either and fighting their own local disputes. Hit the most powerful systems working against the GA, and things will be over faster."
"You realize,"
Palian said,
"that I've been here before, and more than once, And wasn't the short, sharp shock supposed to bring Corellia into line?
Tahiri evidently hadn't been briefed to argue a wider case than the offer to be put on the table. She blinked a couple of times.
It would work if you added your fleet and troops to ours.
Now give me a more immediate benefit for expanding Imperial citizens' lives on this gamble. And it is a gamble.
The GA is prepared to offer you Borleos and Bilbringi.
What are the conditions?
That the Empire first sends vessels and troops to attack Fondor with the GA.
With what objective? Is Jason planning to take over the orbital yards or destroy them? What about the planet itself? Does he simply want to force a surrender? Is he preparing to subdue it by occupation? Each objective requires very different resources.
I think the strategy is something you need to discuss with the Joint Chiefs of State. I'm only here to make the initial offer.
A good point,
Palin said.
I'll put it to the Morphs.
Thank you, Tahiri said. We'll be in touch, I hope.
After she left, Palin summoned Vitor.
Vitor, call the Morphs. Let's see who jumps at this and how fast.
Vitor consulted his datapad and began tapping messages into the office comlink system. Palin waited for the Morphs to gather in the meeting room. The Morphs, predictably, were mostly split between enthusiasm for the Jason Solo plan, ill-defined as it was, and those like Rosette, who wanted to know more before signing up.
I am with you on this, Admiral, said Rosette, sitting opposite him across the mirror-polished table. Putting orbital yards out of action is a very different proposition from subduing the planet itself. Are we going to end up policing Fondor for Jason Solo until Mustafar freezes over?
How badly do we want Bilbringi? Borleos?
Palin asked.
They're not going to be costly to take, said Quill. Very small population on Borleos post, Yuuzhan Vong. Probably happier to have someone like us look after them than not. Bilbringi might require some military effort, though.
Like I mentioned before, Rosette said, we could take both systems if we wanted to without committing anything to the GA, because I don't think Jason is in a position to stop us.
Quill had an expression of almost religious epiphany on his face.
But the GA isn't going to be able to hold Fondor without us, because that'll require an occupying army after it surrenders. Poor old GA, short of hands. And we offer to look after the place while it's busy hammering more wayward systems back into the Alliance fold. We end up staying. And possession is 9/10 of the law, after all.
Rosette let out a long breath.
I think they'll notice we tried to steal Fondor from under their noses.
I don't think they'll see it like that,
Palin interrupted.
If we have Borleos and Bilbringi, then that gives us a platform from which to maintain a presence on Fondor, and then we'll have expanded down past the core again.
Palin didn't have to elaborate on that at all. Every Morph understood the potential.
Are we all agreed then, gentlemen? We accept the GA's invitation, subject to their sharing the Fondor plan with us, and our being able to resource our role.
Normal practice was to go around the table and record votes for and against, but the Morphs paused in silence for a moment, and then all burst into spontaneous applause. Palin wasn't sure if they were applauding him, or simply overwhelmed with martial emotion at the prospect of being back in the saddle.
You're not entirely happy about this, are you, Admiral? Vitor said as he made Palin's nightcap, a mix of two parts Corellian brandy to one part water. You've never appeased the Morphs before, and Jason Solo is...
Anathema to me. Yes, and I'm not appeasing the Morphs now.
Palin stood on the balcony of his chambers, looking out over the parkland beneath.
I'm trying to make the best of a situation that Jason Solo will impose on the galaxy, whether we join him or not.
Palin rolled the brandy glass slowly between his palms and glanced back at Vitor.
Anything else, sir?
Thank you, Vitor, no.
Palin gestured with his glass.
Care to join me?
Perhaps later, sir. I have some work to finish.
I look forward to it.
It was time to take out some insurance. Whatever Jason was planning for Fondor and the Empire, and Palian was certain there was a whole side of the strategy that the Empire would not have been told, Palian needed a trump card of his own.
And not one for the Moffs to see yet either. We have our own Jasons here too,
Palian thought.
Well then, old friend,
he said aloud,
time to call in a favor.
He was simply going to send a message, and one without a single word in it. But she would receive it, and she would know what it meant, and that it was critical, and she would respond. Palian took out a few small flimsy-card trinket boxes from his desk drawer and tapped his fingers on the lid of each in turn, listening for the best approximation of a small drum. Rap, rap, rap. Rap, rap, barap. That was the one. Palian settled down at the desk and positioned his comlink next to the box, ready to drum out his message.
I wouldn't do this unless I had to, my dear,
he said, and opened the comlink. Rap, rap, rap. Rap, rap, barap. It was time for the warrior sailor Darakare to be summoned, as in the Irmenu legend. Palian felt the galaxy was slipping toward its darkest peril, and Jason might have looked like an ally, but Palian knew he was truly a foe, in every sense. Rap, rap, rap. Rap, rap, barap. The drumbeat went out across space. It was just a repeating rhythm that would mean nothing to anyone, except an Irmenu historian, if any could listen in on the secure link, and a warrior sailor, who was, he hoped, still very much alive. Rap, rap, rap. Rap, rap, barap. Palian closed the link and settled in for a long wait.
Office of the Joint Chief of State, Coruscant.
Kaidus ran his fingertips over the nameplate on the outer doors and wondered when he would have the engraving changed to replace Colonel Jason Solo with Darth Kaidus. Just one more push, just one more to break the back of resistance. Make an example of Fondor, Jason thought. The Imperial Remnant was joining him, and that made all the difference. Kaidus's sense of standing on the brink of a pivotal moment was growing stronger. The state of galactic allegiances might not have looked in his favor numerically, but the recruitment of the Moffs to his cause was a coup. Tahiri, he said, where have you been? Tahiri sat down in the chair facing his desk, now looking the ideal junior lieutenant. She'd even pinned up her hair.
I thought you could tell. Can't you detect me?
Kaidus activated the holochart and magnified the Fondor system, moving asset icons into different positions. I don't have time to keep an eye on everyone. He beckoned her over to the holochart table, even though she could easily see the plot if she twisted in the chair. Come here. See my strategy for Fondor. Kaidus moved clouds of small icons, like miniature star clusters, into an irregular ring around Fondor.
So, what am I looking at?
She asked. Kaidus sensed Nyathol coming along the corridor. Her timing was impeccable. She must have seen Tahiri pass the lobby outside her own office. The small icons are mines, he said. I'm not making the same mistake as we did in blockading Corellia. Then we still deluded ourselves that we could bring the planet to its knees by maintaining a civilized picket line, like some customs and excise operation. No, that eats resources, especially when there's a ring of orbital stations to isolate from both planet side and space side. When I deploy warships and fighters, it will be to wage war and fight, not to be run ragged by stopping Confederates from walking on the grass. I'm taking the first element of the Fourth Fleet to Fondor today. The mine layers have already left.
Around the whole planet?
That's the only option. Nyathol's presence blew in like a storm building on the horizon a few moments before she appeared. Kaidus and Tahiri paused and turned together.
Bad form. Yes, I agree. No dead civilians.
Nyathol walked over to the chart, hands clasped behind her back, in her pristine whites and gold braid. She was the quintessence of admiralty, as she cocked her head to study the holoschematic chart of the system.
So, the impenetrable ring of detonite, eh, Jason?
She turned to Tahiri.
How smart you look in a proper uniform, my dear. Welcome to the fleet.
Kytus cut in. I'm deploying to Fondor tonight, remember? I'm sure you'll miss me.
That begs a joke, but I'm no comedian.
5 mine layers should be in position a few hours ahead of the rest of the task force. Jason glanced at the wall chrono. There'll be a shell around the entire planet when I get there. I'll give the blockade a week before we move to the assault phase.
We didn't discuss that.
Oh, I thought of it later.
Why create a mine shell if you don't intend to sit it out? It's not as if we have hulls and troops to spare.
Because I still think we should take the yards sooner rather than later, and we can pick them off once the planet is locked down. Then, when the yards are secured, I intend to capture the capital and main regional centers.
Yes, you did say that. But let me remind you that there are still 5 billion Fondorians, at least half of them on the planet's surface, and most in those cities.
I'm hoping it won't get to that stage. I may sacrifice 1 yard to show I mean business. But Fondor won't want its industrial infrastructure destroyed, will it? Small, rich world, one that will see sense.
Corellia has an even smaller population, and look how well that went.
Nyathol checked the splendid gold fob chrono on her jacket.
My, is that the time? I must be going.
GA Fleet Hangar, Galactic City, 6 hours later.
We're on, said Shivu. The Anakin Solo's cleared orbit.
Ben could see Shivu on the monitor that was set in the CSF speeder's dash.
Okay, Ben said. Let me know if you need a spot of disruption.
Shivu adjusted his helmet as he walked toward the hangar's open doors.
If you ever take up a life of crime, Ben, you'll do staggeringly well at it. Just as well Jedi are pretty honest.
It was just a matter of slipping the CSF forensics droid into the Stealth X. It was a small sphere about the size of a smash ball, disturbingly like a thermal detonator, and packed into its innards were probes, spectrometers, reagents, sample packs, and a full array of sensors that recorded everything at the crime scene it was sent to record. It was perfect for sending into dangerous or inaccessible places that a flesh-and-blood CSF scenes of crime officer couldn't reach, and it was also small enough to be discreet. The only problem was it didn't look like a maintenance droid, and someone might notice. Ben's job was to make sure they didn't. Shivu, in uniform, and taking advantage of the fact that GAG officers could do as they pleased in Jason's new Galactic Order, ambled into the hangar, and the external traffic remote lost him in the shadow. There was a brief fog of static on the monitor as Ben switched from the traffic control holocam to Shivu's helmet cam.
Here we go, said Shivu.
The forward image showed Jason's personal Stealth X sitting in its bay, canopy closed, in a line of X-wings connected to the diagnostic grid by cables and wires. Maintenance droids and a couple of human technicians walked in and out of eyeshot, looking harassed.
Got the droid ready?
I'm watching.
Ben followed Shivu's field of view as the captain walked up to the technicians and asked them when Colonel Solo's Stealth X was starting its maintenance cycle. They assumed they were being nagged to make the vessel a priority.
Okay, we'll do it before the next batch of X-wings,
one technician said in an exasperated tone.
Look, we can only process them so fast, you know. It's okay.
Shivu sounded as if he was relenting.
I'll hang around if you don't mind. You know what a pain in the neck he is about efficiency.
The technicians lapsed into stunned silence, mouths slightly slack with horror. Shivu shrugged and walked away.
Ben, stand by.
Shivu's helmet link showed he was at the Stealth X now. Ben watched Shivu's field of view shake with the 1, 2, 3 of climbing the small ladder up to the cockpit, and the flash of a transparent canopy lifting, followed by the dark interior and matte instrument panel, as Shivu looked inside.
In the hole,
Shivu muttered into his helmet link. Then he climbed back down and wandered apparently aimlessly around the hangar.
Droid on the case.
Most of Ben's attention shifted to the monitor showing the droid's eye view of the cockpit. A fraction of it remained on Shivu's monitor, watching for complications that might require a little force ingenuity from Ben. He could see the smooth matte black curves of the instrument paddle and the small brush-like projections from the droid skimming over plastoid and durasteel, picking up traces and analyzing them before storing the swabbed samples inside the case. An icon on the monitor showed the results as the droid worked. There were traces of skin cells,
machine lubricant, microscopic shavings of metals, and sweat from hands. The droid worked methodically, covering the cockpit deck and bulkheads. It was picking up the odd hair, too. 5 centimeter lengths, short and male. Ben's heart sank. The cockpit must have been cleaned several times in the last few weeks. Then the droid worked over the apparently clean seat. Again, the icon showed skin cells, dust, oils. The probes worked down into seams, and then between the sections that formed the angle of the seat, deep folds of fabric. The icons changed.
Particles, brick, origin unknown, clay, silicates, organic material, hair, female, 29 centimeters, follicular tag present, traces of blood on hair shaft, DNA matches hair.
Oh, oh, oh,
Ben whispered.
Got it?
Shibu's view showed he was near the doors, head moving slowly as if watching nothing in particular.
Ben?
Hair with blood, and a follicular tag, female hair.
If it's got a tag, Ben, it's been probably pulled out.
Ben saw his mother in his memory, tugging her hair and dropping strands into his palm as he stared dumbfounded at her ghost on Cavan.
You did it, Mom.
Lon Shivu's apartment.
That evening, he and Shivu ate their supper in silence. There was a sense of anticlimax.
I'll play Palpatine's advocate, Shivu said, chewing slowly. The hair. First you have to match it to your mother's.
Dad grabbed most of her stuff before he got out. He's got her brushes. Plenty of hair to match up DNA.
I was going on to say that you need to prove there was no other way that the trace could have gotten into the Stealth X.
It was on Jason's clothing.
Ben tried to imagine how his mother's hair got pulled out. She'd bled, though. He could see that when he found her.
They must have fought hand to hand. That's grim.
Take the droid, Shifu said, and let's get you back wherever it is you're hanging out.
Ben opened his mouth to say Endor, but Shifu held up a hand for silence.
I don't need to know. Okay.
Fleet Headquarters, Coruscant.
Niathal made sure she was a daily visitor to Fleet Headquarters, but this was her second trip today, made without notice. Her arrival had thrown the center into a quiet, barely noticeable panic.
Admiral, is there anything I can do?
The Sullustan Ops Center commander hovered, uneasy at having a full admiral of the fleet ensconced in the ops room at a terminal, let alone one who was also Joint Chief of State.
There's always a private office available for you.
Niathal could also have sat back in her own chair and watched Jason's progress on the repeater holochart in her suite at the Senate, but the big picture wasn't what she was interested in. She wanted to see the detail.
I've been neglecting logistics, and I want to get up to speed again.
Niathal called up the holochart from Jason's office node and tried to work out what was inappropriate for Fondor, because something didn't fit. Mines, especially the latest self-dispersing Mersan vigilante type, were quick and easy to lay, and Jason didn't need many ships to do it. 2 for the planet side and perhaps 3 for the outer cordon, simply because so many mines were needed to create a double shell around a planet. Other than that, it was simply a case of telling their program what they needed to do and where, scattering them, and the clever little things made their own way into position and formed their own communications net. They would stand guard for as long as it took, killing anything that tried to pass. They could even be deactivated and rounded up later, like an obedient flock.
The mine layers are an hour into hyperspace, Kenneb said. Give them an hour to deploy on reaching the target and pull back outside the Fondorian limits.
Niathal had to let Luke know the full picture. He would only target Jason, but any commander needed wider context. She'd struggled with that decision on the short journey to HQ, because it would be as good as warning Fondor, and the crews and troops dragged along for Jason's jaunt were her people. She might have been signing their death warrants.
But if I balk at this, if there's any useful intelligence I can safely give the Jedi, GA personnel will almost always be involved,
Niathal thought. No, she couldn't be selective. She had to choose now. It was literally a sickening sensation.
If Fondor doesn't roll over when faced with the prospect of having one or two of its cities turned into transparasteel parking lots, how is Jason going to occupy the planet?
Nyathol thought. He'd embarked with 150,000 troops. Taking 10 orbital yards would tie up most of them, and assuming they succeeded, it was labor-intensive to keep an eye on an industrial process where disgruntled workers would sabotage operations in 1,000 small places. It wasn't enough even in the short to medium term.
What's the latest estimate of the strength of the Remnant Task Force?
She asked.
They're standing by with 20 Star Destroyers and carriers with air group embarked. Assorted cruisers, auxiliaries, landing craft, and fast patrol vessels. No firm numbers on personnel overall, but a first wave of 50,000 troops for the blockade, and they have small special forces units embarked to take strategic targets as required. They plan to join Colonel Solo just before the assault.
I'd better talk to Palian, see if he thinks this is genius or madness. I'm finished for the day. If anything changes, calm me.
Nyathol valued the transit time from HQ to the Senate. Her official speeder had tinted screens and soundproofing, and so it was a haven, a few minutes each day when she could clear her mind.
Jason isn't stupid. Not stupid enough to try to take Fondor with a fraction of the troops he needs, anyway. I just hope the Imperials are as good as their word. I bet they think they're going to get Fondor as a bonus for their trouble.
The chauffeur dropped her off at her club for the evening, and instead of savoring that brief respite when the biggest decision she had to make was what to order from the menu, she swept her room for eavesdropping devices and then composed an encrypted data sheet for Luke Skywalker with every detail he might need. She wasn't sure how many Jedi had regrouped on Endor, but they had a way of punching way, way above their weight. When Luke appeared, she spoke quickly.
Master Skywalker, Fondor will be ring-fenced by vigilante mines. Double shell. I estimate 4 or 5 hours, and the fleet will follow shortly afterward.
Luke paused, as if he was visualizing that.
I think Fondor was expecting something after the skirmish with the Anakin Solo.
Yes, that was provocative. But there's more. Jason's following at 2359, with part of the 4th Fleet and 150,000 troops. He's planning to isolate the orbital yards by mines and force a surrender. Or so he says. The Imperial Remnant is backing him up. I'm sending you the data now. I'll update it when I can.
Thanks, Admiral.
You're welcome, Master Skywalker. Go ahead and ruin his day for me.
Brousey, near Keldarbe.
It's hard not to hate the Vong, Jaina said. She slipped off the pillion seat of the speeder bike and looked downhill, hand shielding her eyes against the sun. The broad, shallow valley that sloped away from her was a patchwork of cultivated fields, woodland, ancient circular fortified homesteads, and a rash of small, round roofs that marked new homes being built.
I don't try.
Bevin unloaded the panniers and stacked armor plates.
I have a good hat and feel better for it. Better out than in, that's what I say.
Did you bring me up here for the view?
Not really,
Bevin said.
But we won't have an audience, and it's a spot with its own history.
Yeah, I do seem to draw a crowd in your barn. You should sell tickets.
A lot of folks haven't seen a live Jedi before.
That's not very reassuring.
Just a figure of speech.
Jaina followed Bevin to the top of the small hill, a gently rounded dome that flattened out into downs dotted with trees and bushes. The feel of the place made her nape bristle in a way that battlefields did, but many times magnified. It wasn't actually a feeling of dread, just a sense that terrible things had happened, but that it had somehow been triumphant, even oddly content in the end. Across the expanse of short, spongy grass was an avenue of trees. She couldn't see what it led to, but it led to something. She felt it.
Sacred site?
She asked. Bevin bent over and took a few swings at the turf with his Beskad. He looked as if he was digging for something.
I can feel something happened here. A battle, maybe.
Vongese. But no prizes for guessing that. Come over here.
A skull seemed to have worked its way out of the soil. It wasn't Mandalorian,
Jaina could tell from the odd ridges that ran from brow to crown on its one clean side that it had been a Yuuzhan Vong soldier. But it still looked quite human, far more human than the Yuuzhan Vong had been in life, when they were so proud of the ritual facial mutilations that made them look utterly alien.
"I think there were a few thousand of them," Bevin said. "And this was a poor place to defend, but we took them on."
Bevin drew a saber and lined the blade up carefully with the split in the bone. It slotted into it neatly.
"In it," he said, pointing to the avenue of trees, "is Fen Shise's memorial. Your mother knew him, and your Uncle Luke, too. Pay your respects and we can get on with your lessons."
It was a battered red and green helmet on a plinth. No inscription, no railings, nothing that indicated its owner had been a head of state, or even who was commemorated. It was hard to know how to be reverent toward a helmet. Jaina did what she would do at a state funeral, and simply bowed her head for a moment, as Jedi did.
"Let's get on with it, then," she said.
The training armor wasn't custom fitted, and the helmet was just a head guard, but it was Beskar. The worst injury she could get while sparring was bruising from impact. Bevin took out two metal sabers and handed her one, hilt first.
"Durasteel," he said. "And so's this one, because we both want to see our grandchildren grow up. Come on."
"So you think I should try to face down my brother with a real saber?" Jaina said, hefting it and testing the weight.
"No, I think you should learn a different technique, because you're predictable."
"Because Jedi all learn the same basic moves?"
Bevin demonstrated a few mock lightsaber passes.
"It's all long sweeps. Every part of the blade cuts, so you don't have to think about the angle. It's light, so you don't put much weight into the blow. And you spend a lot of energy leaping around opponents, just trying to get past their defense. See what happens if you get used to a Beskar. It'll change how you handle that shiny stick."